Well, good morning. I'm Matt. I'm the minister here at Maybridge. I've not said that for a few months because I've been on sabbatical. And it's great to be back. It's one of those things where I said, I'm going on sabbatical, and loads of people were really enthusiastic at the thought of me being away for 3 months. But in seriousness, it was great. Thank you as a church for letting me do that. It was really good. But it's also really good to be back. And we are in the first of 4 weeks we're going to do, Ross said this earlier, that we call Partnership Month. And we do it every year. And the idea is we talk about what church is about, both in general and this church. And we give everyone an opportunity to sign up to what we call partnership, which basically means saying, I am committed to doing the Christian journey with this bunch of people, this bunch of imperfect people, together over the year ahead. And this is basically for if you've been at Maybridge for 30 years or 3 weeks or everything in between. And it's a time when every year we talk about our vision as a church, we talk about our values, and our vision basically is this. We want to build a vibrant church community that relentlessly follows Jesus and extravagantly shares the goodness of God. And our values really are about living that out. They're our DNA, so to speak. And they're all basically come from stuff in the Bible, but expressed in our own way. And they are these. We do life together, we get stuck in, we're here for you, and we're all about Jesus. Very simply put, and the last one is the most important, by the way. And we're going to talk about one value each week for the next 4 weeks, but with an eye on how do we get practical with it. If you're here today and you're new to Maybridge, this is a good way to check us out. If you're not somebody who identifies as a Christian, also true, this is a good way to check us out. We're basically talking about the point of church. This is not a challenge for you to just live differently, but to show what life is like once you start following Jesus. And today, number one, we do life together. We do life together. We believe that church is more than just a Sunday gathering like this. And the phrase comes from a passage in the New Testament in a book called 1 Thessalonians. And that's a letter where an early church leader and thinker called Paul and his friends Silas and Timothy wrote to a church in the ancient Greek city of Thessalonica. And Paul had spent time in the city. He'd come to really love the people there. He told them about Jesus. A bunch of them became Christians. And that was how the church began. And I want to look at this today because this tells us a lot about what church is meant to be like, including what doing life together means. Here's what it says early in chapter 1. You became imitators of us and of the Lord, for you welcomed the message in the midst of severe suffering with the joy given by the Holy Spirit. And so you became a model to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. The Lord's message rang out from you, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, your faith in God has become known everywhere. So this tells us some backstory. Paul and his mates had been in the city. Even though life is difficult, these people hear about Jesus. They don't just believe the message in their minds. They're excited about it. They have a faith. They begin to trust the God they've heard about. And this is when you know that someone has got it, when a penny has dropped, when people are excited about what they've heard about Jesus. It's amazing. And so this little church begins in the city of Thessalonica, and the faith they have sort of spills out like someone has tipped a big jug of water on a map. And their joy is so remarkable, it spreads. They become well known. People in Macedonia and Achaia hear about it too. So it's like a really big geographical area. It's like if somebody said, hey, Maybridge Community Church, your faith and joy are so amazing that people know about you all over the UK. It would be like if that happened. And the point was not to say, right, you guys have arrived. You're like the perfect church. It wasn't that. It wasn't saying you're the best church ever. It was to say, this is your story. This is what has happened because you follow Jesus in the right way. And it's made a difference. And other people are getting inspired too. What happened with the hindsight of history in the Thessalonian church was unbelievable. What was their secret is the natural question. What happened there that had such a powerful effect? Were they more intelligent than everybody else? Were they more well off so they could pay for loads of cool resources? Well, no. Like, we know historically, these were not more educated people. They did not have more money than all the other churches. Their reputation was all about their attitude. That was the game changer. And we can see how it came together, because Paul recalls in what we're about to read, when he and his friends had been there, it was a few years earlier they'd actually been there, what was it that was so significant, so influential, that it set up the culture of this one church so well? I don't know about you, if there's a formula for healthy church, I want to know what it is. Maybe there's not a formula, but there are certain things that help. And that's what we see in this passage. So 1 Thessalonians 2, Paul looks back and he says this: "You know, brothers and sisters, our visit to you was not without results. We had previously suffered and been treated outrageously in Philippi, as you know, but with the help of our God, we dared to tell you his gospel in the face of strong opposition. For the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives, nor are we trying to trick you. On the contrary, we speak as those approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We are not trying to please people, but God, who tests our hearts. You know we never used flattery, nor do we put on a mask to cover up greed. God is our witness. We were not looking for praise from people, not from you or anyone else, even though as apostles of Christ, we could have asserted our authority. Instead, we were like young children among you. Just as a nursing mother cares for her children, so we cared for you. Because we loved you so much, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. Surely you remember, brothers and sisters, our toil and hardship. We worked night and day in order not to be a burden to anyone while we preached the gospel of God to you. You are our witnesses, and so is God, of how holy, righteous, and blameless we were among you who believed. For you know that we dealt with each of you as a father deals with his own children, encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory." So basically, this is a description of what Paul and his friends actually did in the city of Thessalonica. They shared the gospel. In other words, they talked about Jesus and what it meant to follow him, and they did that a lot. But it wasn't the only thing they did. They didn't just talk. It wasn't a sort of mechanical thing, right? Well, we're going to tell you the message, we'll write it down for you, and then we're going to go home. We've done our job, we'll see you later. Wasn't that. You may have noticed the phrase in there: we shared not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. This is where we get the idea of doing life together. It's a good summary of the whole thing, and it's key, because Paul's saying, you know, we didn't just show up and do some Bible studies. Yes, there was a message, a wonderful message, but also look at the investment in the community. And the rest of the passage basically just fleshes out what that looks like. What seeds were sown in this tiny church community in Thessalonica? What is the super amazing in the Bible formula for a healthy church? Well, there are hints scribbled all over this memory that Paul has about what he and Silas did, what formed the Thessalonian church from the foundations upwards. And I think what he says is intended to be at the heart of every church that has existed since, about how we do life together here and now. But for today, for our purposes, I've boiled it down into three what I call healthy church culture tips that Paul gives. The first one, healthy culture, church culture tip number one: genuine integrity. How unspectacular does that sound? They had integrity. Is there anything more boring than integrity? You were hoping to be like miracles or some special spiritual thing, right? No, the first of three things that built this incredible church in Thessalonica 2,000 years ago: integrity. It's a bit boring, isn't it? Let's be honest, you were thinking that, it's a bit boring. Here's the thing. I bet all the people that you like and respect have integrity. I bet everybody you like and respect has integrity. All the people that you trust and would open up to, I would guess, have integrity. A community cannot run, cannot thrive without integrity. And Paul is at pains to remember that that happened when he was in the city. Look at some of his words. The appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives, nor are we trying to trick you. Integrity. We speak as those approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. Integrity. You are witnesses, and so is God, of how holy, righteous, and blameless we were among you. Integrity. In other words, there was a remarkable connection between what Paul and Silas told people about Jesus and how they actually lived their lives. Enough of a connection that Paul can look back a couple of years later and say, you know what we were like. It's not arrogance, it's just saying how it was. You saw how we actually lived when we were there. When Paul and Silas did life with these people, there had to be a connection between their message and their actions. Everything they said about Jesus would have sounded hollow if at the same time they'd lied and gossiped and manipulated and been defensive and promoted themselves. Of course, we know when someone puts themselves out there and says, Jesus is the center of everything, follow Jesus, he should be followed with everything that you have. If at the same time in your behavior, you show that you don't really believe that, it's unlikely anybody's going to pay much attention, isn't it? I remember hearing this incredible story once, and I wish I could find out the details again, but I can't, to get the exact details. And this story is from about 100 years ago, and it's about the beginning of one of the big shopping chains in this country. I don't remember which, doesn't matter. And back then, like 100 years ago, it was one shop, and it was run by one man and his assistant. So it's very small at this point. And then one day, the owner of the shop saw a customer coming in, and he said to his assistant, I don't want to speak to him today. The last thing I want is a chat with him. I'm going to go in the back. If he comes over, tell him I'm not here. Tell him I'm not in, okay? So the owner goes into the back, and the customer he's into the shop, he comes up to the front of the shop, and he says to the assistant, where's the boss? I want to have a chat with him. And the assistant said, he's out the back. I'll go and get him. So he has to come out and they have this conversation. Later on, the owner was really annoyed with the assistant. Why did you do that? I told you, lie for me. I'm telling him I'm out the back. You've told him I'm here straight. What's all that about? And the assistant said, if I'm willing to lie for you, how will you ever know if I'm willing to lie to you? If I'm willing to lie for you, how will you ever know if I'm willing to lie to you? And that had a profound effect on the owner. And they built a bond of trust, which ultimately meant that shop grew from one shop to a whole chain of shops that is around the country to this day. Because from that moment, the owner knew he had somebody in the business that he could trust completely. Integrity works. It's the platform for everything else in a good community. Now, of course, going back to the Thessalonian church, it's not that Paul and Silas were perfect. Obviously not. Part of being holy, righteous, and blameless, which sounds very grand, is just being honest about your own weaknesses. I have no doubt that when Paul and Silas made mistakes, they said, yeah, that's true, that was me, I just owned up to it. I think they would actually have been honest about their own weaknesses to a point that we would be uncomfortable with. Because it was never about them getting it right, it was about Jesus. Which means living out the good news about Jesus is not just being a good person, it's actually being a lot more honest than maybe we'd be comfortable with other people. For us to have integrity is not just to go about things in the right way, but to be honest about where we're wrong, where we're not the heroes of the story. And so as we do life together as a church, which is a value, it's a good thing, we might picture ourselves doing life by being with other people socially and having lots of fun, or supporting people with meal trains when they had a baby, or visiting somebody who's sick. And those are all really appropriate and really good things. But when you think of doing life together, how often do you think about your own character quality? Because that's fundamental, that's central. How often do you think about telling the truth and living what you say you believe? Because if you do spend time with people, it will become very clear what you really believe by the way that you live. In a healthy church, integrity is the unspectacular foundation for everything else. If we don't have it, we have nothing. Second healthy church culture tip, number two. Relationships of purpose. Again, unspectacular. It's bubbling under the surface in this passage until it's clear at the end. And Paul says that he and Silas were encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God who calls you into his kingdom and glory. What it means is this. Encouraging is not just telling somebody something positive about themselves so they feel better. Encouragement is specifically inspiring someone towards God. Comforting is not just being nice when someone is suffering, although that's not a bad thing. Comforting is helping someone see the goodness of God while they're suffering. Urging is not pestering somebody to do better. Urging is putting your heart and energy into exhorting someone to live in God's ways. And none of this is because we can achieve a life worthy of God through just a bit more hard work. The idea is that it's our direction of travel, who we're becoming, who he intends us to be. And it's very clear that Paul sees his relationships as having a purpose, and that purpose is for everybody else to move closer to God. The passage is full of words that tell us how intentional he was about everything. Whatever he could do to be good news to the Thessalonians, he did it. We cared for you. We loved you. You remember when we did this. The affection just drips out of the text. But one thing is clear. Part of being purposeful in his relationships is that he must have spent lots of time with them. You can't have the influence Paul had and talk about how your good character was visible with other people unless you've spent actual time with them. This church was not Paul's hobby or even his job. It was the center of his life rhythms. And I wonder how often we stop to think about this question. How much time do I put into doing life with my church community? Not just a Sunday service, good as they are. And of course, there's so many pulls on our time. We work lots of hours. We've got stuff with kids. We've got our hobbies. We've got home improvements we've got to do. And of course, we've got different circumstances, our health, people who depend on us. If we work shifts, that can be a bit tricky. But I've noticed, and I speak to people from other churches, and I think it's true across the board, there's two opposing things that are happening in our culture right now. On the one hand, there is a greater felt need than ever for community. People are talking about it and looking for it, and they want it. We've had people with no church background whatsoever call the church office several times in the last few weeks, looking for help, needing the care of other people. So people are looking for community relationships. On the other hand, since COVID, people attend things less. Maybe coming to a service once a month when it used to be pretty much every week. Many churches report people being slower to volunteer for stuff. I will say at Maybridge, I think we're actually pretty good at that one. But I've noticed that the people who feel most disconnected at church and say, oh, I'm not feeling connected, I don't feel, you know, known, etc., are often the people who are simply not around very much. And regardless of anyone's good intentions, if you don't show up, you will not be able to build and maintain relationships. You won't participate in healthy church community. You won't be following the ways of Jesus because that's not possible without showing up and being part of church. And so when we think about this in terms of partnership at Maybridge, when we ask people to become partners or continue as partners, we're not saying write down your details on a bit of paper. We're saying participate as a family member. Be present. Yes, come on Sundays. Stay around for coffee. Volunteer for stuff. Get involved in the life of the church. But also just spend time with people. Choose to spend time with people while you're doing the things that you'd be doing anyway. And if Sundays or our midweek partnership groups are genuinely a struggle, look for the other things that you can do. My friend Duncan Slaney, who I'll embarrass, who sat at the back there, is one of our church elders, one of our leaders, and he works shifts. And so he misses a lot of Sundays, don't you? Because you have to, because sadly we need policemen at the weekend in this country, I'm sure in every country. But he's no less committed. He just finds different ways of being involved. He invites people to walk the dog with him, which I've done a few times, if that's your thing. So you get some exercise, you catch up with each other, doing life together. It's wonderful. Over the summer, as I mentioned before, I was on sabbatical. And unfortunately, I had to rip up the decking in our garden and put in a patio, which I can recommend never, ever doing because it's a lot of work. And I don't know what I'm doing, as is with so many things in life. But John Goddard, who you may know, is part of our Breakfast Church congregation, offered to help me. And it was amazing because, well, he's an expert in patios, it turns out. But it's also fantastic because I got to know him better. I asked him about his life and all these great things that he's done. And if you know John, he is not shy of talking. Just doing stuff with people that we'd be doing anyway and inviting them along is part of being purposeful. Honestly, if you invite someone to be part of anything in your life, I guarantee they will be blessed by you asking. They might say no, because they can't make that one. They will not resent you for it. I think there's loads of people out there, you may be one of them, who actually feel a bit lonely and would love if someone invited them to just get involved in something with them. Just be the person that asks. Now you might ask, this talk of intentional relationships, purposeful relationships, is the danger that they become a bit fake? In my experience, relationships with purpose are not fake, they're full. They're not fake, they're full. So how about choosing, as a church partner, to pursue, with your words, your time, your energy, those relationships that have depth to them, that involve comforting and encouraging and urging, as appropriate, because you've got that sort of relationship, because you've built it, because you've put the time into doing it. Why not do that as a partner this year? Third and final thing, healthy church tip number three, being true family. If you read the whole letter that we've been looking at, 1 Thessalonians, it's 5 chapters long, and Paul uses 24 different family analogies to understand the relationship between the Christians there and himself and God. The whole way that he thinks of church is understood in terms of family relationships. He calls them brothers and sisters. At different points, he characterizes himself and Silas as like young children or like mothers and fathers. And this was radical language at the time. Maybe it still is. It was absolutely central to all the great stuff that happened in the city that they were a family to each other, and they knew it. We often talk about being a church family, we might use that phrase, which is great. Who doesn't like the sound of that? But how often does that show up in what we actually choose? When people are your family, they are your family 24/7, not for an hour on Sunday. That's the model that we see in Thessalonica that Paul says has impacted loads of people. We are God's family to one another all the time. And what I think is great in the passage we looked at is Paul and Silas, in a sense, took on different family roles at different times. So at one point, Paul remembers them nurturing like a mother. In other words, they were giving out care. But another time he says, we were like little children among you. In that context, meaning we weren't authoritarian. We didn't assume a position as if we were above you. And I love this because church is a family, but it's a family of equals. People may have different leadership roles, but those come and go. It's not meant to be that some do all of the work and others do all the receiving. But everybody is involved, and at different points, everybody benefits in different ways. And if you do see people as family, you treat them a bit differently, even if they behave a bit badly or they rub you up the wrong way sometimes. They're family, so you stick with them. Because Paul saw the Thessalonians as family, he invested time, he cared spiritually, practically, everything, all of life. It's not that they all had individual personal relationships with God in the way we sometimes talk about in the West now. They were a family. They didn't just meet for a weekly service. And one of the things that was radical and remains radical about the church is this, is when we see each other as family and when we live as family. I have a great friend who I will not name, but his biological family had been very difficult towards him and even rejected him. And he said to me once, the church really is my family. It was true in his lived experience. The church is my family. But I find most people really like the idea of church being a close-knit, supportive community. Everyone is cared for. Everyone is challenged. Everyone has fun together. And there's different kinds of people, you know, diversity. Everybody loves that in theory. I haven't met anybody who doesn't like that in theory. and yet somehow, in practice, is tricky. The problem with being a close community of people is the people, right? Now, I find in my nuclear family, there's me and there's Naomi and there's three small children. And even though we love each other, it's not all plain sailing, is it, darling? No, she's shaking her head. And it's not just us that feels that way about our family, right? Anybody else found that with their family, that it's not always plain sailing? And what holds it together is that Naomi and I have a permanent commitment to each other and the kids. And that sits under everything else that happens. The commitment to each other overcomes any disagreement or difficulty, and it compels us to resolve things and seek peace and be in good relationships. But the underlying glue is that we've got a commitment to each other that goes beyond the day-to-day stuff. And church is meant to be like that, only it's bigger and more complicated. Church is full of family that you didn't choose. It's full of people you don't agree with about so many million things. It's like the weird cousin with extreme politics, so you only see at weddings. But at church, they're always there, all the time. And that is exactly how God intended church. You see, if church was full of people exactly like you, it would be a disaster. We're all tempted to think, oh, if only everybody thought like me at church, it'd be amazing. No, if everybody at church was exactly like you, it would be a disaster. It would be terrible. Besides the lack of diversity and limited number of gifts and strengths, there's an even bigger thing, and it's this. Basically, the main thing God is doing in your life is honing and forming and refining your character so you are more like Jesus. That's what he's doing. And that's the best thing that could possibly happen to you, because Jesus is the greatest person ever. It's not helping you achieve your goals. It's not releasing your potential. It's making you more like his son. And what God intended for church is that it helps everybody be more like Jesus than they would have been on their own. That is literally the point of church, is that everybody is more like Jesus than they would have been if they were on their own. And that means that all the people in church who are not like you are really helpful. That person who's really irritating, you're thinking of someone right now. It might be me. That person who's really irritating, every encounter with them is an opportunity to grow your patience and be more like Jesus. That person who's got very different theology to you, that's a chance to think about what you believe and grow in wisdom and be more like Jesus. Even that person who did that awful thing that really upset you, that's a challenge to stay the course and forgive and be more like Jesus. The way of the world is to avoid people who are different to you, who are annoying or who hurt you. But the way of Jesus is to embrace the other, to grow affection, to forgive those who are not like you, those who hurt you. And it's flipping hard work, of course it is. But when it's done, there are glimpses of the way that God intended it to be, and it's incredibly powerful. There is something about choosing to love and invest in one another, even when we're different, even when it's hard, that unlocks something incredible. We as Christians often get worked up about our projects and our plans and our songs and our sermons, and we've got ideas about how this should all be done. But actually, the down-to-earth, everyday love of people who we would have no business being friends with apart from Jesus is the thing that changes us and speaks to our world. So in this passage, Paul and Silas started a church community that became known internationally by spending a season doing life with people, having integrity, purposeful relationships, seeing people as family while they told them about Jesus. Really down-to-earth stuff. But imagine if we grew and grew at living that way as a church ourselves, really taking on what it really means to do life together. Now, you might think about some of that passage I read and have talked about and think, well, that sounds like good stuff. Fine. I can see why we should do it. But, you know, even if I committed myself to growing in integrity, having purposeful relationships, seeing people as family, well, how much would that even impact anybody around me anyway? How would it even affect me? What difference would that make? Remember again, this Thessalonian church was totally shaped by the relatively brief, actually, investment of a couple of people following God's ways and armed only with the good news about Jesus. That's all they had. And right back at the beginning, Paul said to them, "You know, brothers and sisters, our visit to you was not without results." Not without results. Now, we've got to be careful here. It's not about results like church is a business or anything. You know, we're not looking at spreadsheets and, you know, is it all happening? But I think that when people, and even more so whole communities, get on with doing things like we see in this passage and others like it, results are inevitable. That they're a certainty. We don't know what they are. We don't know when and how they'll happen. But I completely believe if we live in integrity with purposeful relationships and embrace each other as family, we will see fruit as a church. Don't know what the fruit is. We will grow personally and we will impact people profoundly. It will just happen if we do some of the stuff we see in this passage. Now, if you sat here and you're thinking, it's hot and it's the end of summer and this is all very heavy, here's the why behind it all. If you've got one thing to take home and you want to photograph something on the screen, which sometimes people do, it's this. Jesus came into our world, died and rose again, so that he could do life with each of us forever. Jesus came into our world, died and rose again, so he could do life with each of us forever. That's what he wants. The purpose of our existence is to enjoy relationship with God and other people. Why would you do anything else? Why would you invest in anything else? What else is there that's so great? Let me pray and then I'll hand back to Roz. Father God, thank you for the great examples we see in this passage. We want to do life together because you set the pattern. Jesus came and did life with us when he didn't need to. He just wanted to. Help us as a church to follow after him, even when it's inconvenient, uncomfortable, and costly, because he is worth following. Let us be a church that in the years ahead is known for humbly investing love in one another and our community. Amen.